All right, we're beginning here on the bottom of Samach Bet Amud Bet, four lines from the bottom. Amar Abaye, Rabbi Elezer ben Yaakov, Verabi, Verabi Meir, Kulhu Sfir Lehu, Adam Makne, Davar Shalou Badu Olam. You have these three Tanaim who are all of the same belief, that you are able to create kinyanim around things that have yet to come in the world, possibly also intangible items, stuff that is not under your auspices and physically present right now. You are able to make a kinyan on those items. We saw Rabbi Eliezer ben Yaakov Hadamran. So Rabbi Eliezer ben Yaakov said yesterday, with regards to a field full of produce that is still attached, that he can make a condition that says that once they grow and reach one third of their maturation, and then they are severed, that is still good for taking off the truma. When you go ahead and sever those items, they can be truma in the future, which was davar shelo badi olam. On that, we had the qualification of Rabbi and Rabbi Yosef as to how early that would be true. Is that only b'shachat, or is that even when it's butzlana, even if it's just emerged from the ground, how early on can that be? And then we spoke about that with regards to the ubar, with regards to a fetus, Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov's view that a person can create kiddushin even with the fetus that will come in the future. So we saw that in Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov's shita yesterday. Truth is that here the Gemara equates Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov with Rabbi Meir, and we know that Rabbi Meir believes that you can make a kinyan on fruits, that it would come on the tree in the future. So why is it here by the case of ubar and other situations, we don't say that Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov says also, with regards to the field, that why does it have to be emerged? Why does it have to be shachat? Again, also here by the ubar, why is there a question about hikur ubara or not? So that might have to do with a tree, by design or by nature, always gives fruits. So I mentioned yesterday that throughout Shas, there are Moraim who argue within Rabbi Meir's Shita as to how extensive he says that davar shelo badi olam. Is it going to be completely intangible, completely not there? Or is it something like a tree that by design or by nature will give fruits every year? So if you talk about a tree or speak about a tree, which is something that naturally gives fruits, that's very different than a field that is planted, because that is really something that's coming from nothing. It's coming from the seeds and they have to come out. So maybe the field would be different than the dekel, asuya de perutea. And the same is true with regards to the ubar. You would have to argue about here with regards to the ubar is how distinct is it from its mother. We have a principle of ubar yerechimo, that an ubar fetus is an extension of the mother. On the other hand, we know that the ubar has a certain independence or status that is separate from the mother. And so that might also be part of what causes the discussion within Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov Shita as to how far along do these items have to be in order for them to be ra'ui l'kinyan, versus other cases where it seems that we don't have any of those requirements or any minimums, because in those cases there's either a natural outcome that will bring to whatever the production is, or it's easily to discern and say that these items are separate from the item that is producing them. Right, so that's Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov. Rabbi d'tanya. Rabbi is because of a braita. Lo tazgir eved el adonav. You're not allowed to return an eved to its master. So the problem with the pasuk, which is dealt with in Yevamot and Gittin, is that if the master freed the slave, then is this an instruction to Beit Din not to return the slave into slavery? But then it shouldn't have said lo tazgir eved el adonav. Eved means that he's still a slave. So it's saying here, don't return a slave to his master. If the master freed him, he's not a slave. So then what's the instruction? Don't return the slave to the master. It means don't return the freed slave to the master. So the pasuk was written incorrectly if that's the real interpretation. Therefore, the Gemara gives different interpretations. Here we're going to see Rabbi's interpretation. The other interpretation in the Gemara in Yevamot and Kitin is that a slave that runs away from his master and goes to Eretz Yisrael, that you're not allowed to return him to his master. And that's the schut of Eretz Yisrael, that if the slave runs to Eretz Yisrael, that he's entitled to a shichrur. We demand that he gets a get shichrur from the master in order to free him, and he would create an IOU for the money that he owes him for that. But that is not the way Rabbi learns it. Rabbi learns it this way. Rabbi Omer, lokeach eved amanat l'shachro akatuv medaber. It's a case where he purchases an eved on the condition or with the intent to free the slave. Hey, chidami, what exactly is the case here? So Rav Nachman Yisrael, go to Kotav Lei, he wrote to him in a shtar, l'kishe'ekechecha, harei atzmecha, kanui l'cha mi'achshav. when I purchase you, you will be able to acquire yourself from now. So Rabbi is clearly dealing with a situation where you don't own the slave. That's why he's an Eved. So what does it mean, lo tazgir Eved ala dunav? Don't take an Eved who is an Eved right now and is still an Eved except for the fact that you freed him. Well, how did you free him? You said, when I buy you in the future, I will free you. It's clear that he can't free him now. He doesn't own him to free him. So he is making a promise or commitment to free him in the future once he has bought him. So that's a davar shelo bali olam. It's something that does not exist today, which is the ownership of you over that slave. And yet you're still committing yourself at this point to free the slave in the future. So as the rabbi says, the pasuk teaches you that in this circumstance, Beit Din should not force the slave to go back, and that this is binding. That which he committed to is binding, showing you that davar shelo ba le'olam, you can create a kinyan on davar shelo ba le'olam. Rabbi Meir, where is the case of Rabbi Meir? The Tanya. Omer le'isha, hare at mikudeshet li lachar she'etgayer. This is the equivalent of our Mishnah, which I noted in our Mishnah. Our Mishnah is an opinion that is opposed to Rabbi Meir's opinion. And here is Rabbi Meir's opinion, which is, if he says, we'll be married after I convert, la'achar she'tit gairi, after you convert, la'achar she'eshtachrer, after I become free, la'achar she'tishtachri, after you are freed, la'achar she'imot baleich, after your husband passes away, la'achar she'tamut achutech, after your sister passes away. So over here, he's putting like a placeholder and saying, I'm next in line. If my wife passes away, we'll be married. After your Yavam does Chalitza with you, then I'll marry you. Eina Mikudeshet. Like our Mishnah, no Kiddushin over here. Rabbi Meir Omer, Mikudeshet. Rabbi Meir says they are married, seemingly because he believes Davar Shelo Ba'al Olam can be a Kinyan. Rabbi Yochanan Sanlan Omer, Eina Mikudeshet. Rabbi Yochanan Zanlander seemingly agrees with the Tanakama. Rabbi Yehuda Nasi Omer Mikudeshet. Rabbi Yehuda Nasi agrees with Rabbi Meir and says Mikudeshet. Uma Tam Amru Eina Mikudeshet. Yet he disagrees with them in certain instances. Mishum Eva. What are those certain instances? So Rashi delineates them and says, Evat Achuta Bevat Bala. We don't allow you to start putting bids on a woman saying that when her husband passes away, that we'll be married. Because that doesn't lead to a good situation for their current marriage. The wife is basically in waiting for her husband to pass away so she can marry the next guy. Or the sister. It's not the type of circumstance that we want to create. So even though technically it works, from a concern over good relations, we don't want people entering into these types of transactions. And therefore we say, Eina Mikudeshet. And the same with the sister. He's married to this woman and then he says to the sister, I'm going to marry you when my wife passes away. Again, that does not lead to good relations right now between the husband and wife if he's already putting dibs on her sister for the future. So Rashi says in those two instances, Mishum Eivad, that we don't do that. In the other circumstances, there is not this issue of Eivad because we're not dealing with parties where we're saying in the future, when you pass away or when you're out of the picture, something will happen. So Rashi says, V'nachshov nami Rabbi Yehuda Nasi. Why don't we include Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, who just over here agreed with Rabbi Meir, if it were not for this Takanad Rabbanan in those two instances of Eivav, but the others, he all agrees with him, or fundamentally, he agrees with him. So, Hainu, Rabbi. Hainu, Rabbi Yehuda Nasi. So here, the Gemara makes it clear, something that we take for granted, that everybody knows, that Rabbi Yehuda Nasi is Rabbi. That is the name that was given, the title that was given to Rabbi Yehuda Nasi was Rabbi. Therefore, the Gemara says over here, when it says Rabbi Yehuda Nasi in this case, and when we said Rabbi before, it's the same individual. And so we already counted Rabbi. You don't have to worry about that. Menachshov nami Rabbi Akiva. Let us also count Rabbi Akiva. Tanya. Because we have a bright that's really Tanan, a Mishnah. Konam shani osa lepicha. The woman says, or takes a neder, that anything I make is asur to you, meaning to her husband. Ain't sarich lafer. You don't have to do a hafarat nidarim because the woman doesn't have a right to do that. She doesn't own her output in order to be oseret on her husband. I mean that you can't come along and tell a person, you know what, so-and-so stuff is asur to you because you don't own it. You have to be a party to the situation in order to be able to be oseret. So to over here, where she is married to the husband, in exchange for mizonot, her maseya dayim belong to the husband. So now she's coming along and saying, oh, your stuff is asur on you. She doesn't have a right to do that, and therefore you don't need her for a... Rabbi Akiva Omer, Yafer, Shema Ta'adif Alav. Termin Aroi Lo. The problem is not her Masei Yadayim, her core Masei Yadayim, which are owed to the husband. The problem is that she could exceed the amount that she's committed to give to her husband. Mishnah Ketubot lays out, that's 5 Slayim of Shti in Yehuda, which is 10 Slayim in the Galil. So she has a fixed amount which she's supposed to cover. If she exceeds that amount, then that amount belongs to her. And that amount, she could be Oser. Okay, so let her be Oser that amount. The problem is, it's hard to be Meduk-Dik. Meaning that to get to that fine line and know exactly where she hits the threshold by which he owns it, and the area where in excess of that belongs to her, that's a very difficult calculation to make or to be so exact. And therefore, we say to him, be Mayfair, so we avoid that problem. And that way, the neder goes away. The reason I'm saying that is because the Baal Yetzer Tzvot asks over here, when it comes to Hafarat Nedarim, the nullification by the husband of the Nedarim of his wife, he only has rights to do that Be'inui Nefesh, and Darim should Be'ino the Be'ina. So it has to be something that is of their intimate relationship, or something that's Inui Nefesh. Over here, this doesn't qualify as either of these. The Baal Yetzer Tzvot answer, it does, because of this problem, because there's such a fine line between making her quota versus exceeding her quota, it becomes an issue where he's going to be at risk now of beginning hana or being violation of a neder, and therefore that becomes an issue that's serious enough where he could be made for the neder. Based on that, Rabbi Akiva is clearly saying, as you noted, that this is davar shelo ba liolam. She has yet to produce whatever it is here, and she is creating a neder that blocks or assers that which she has yet to create. That's a davar shelo ba liolam. So why isn't Rabbi Akiva included in our list? And given the fact that Rabbi Meir has that opinion, it wouldn't be so far-fetched. Rabbi Meir is a Talmud of Rabbi Akiva, so it wouldn't make a lot of sense that Rabbi Meir got a shita from his Rebbe, Rabbi Akiva. So why isn't Rabbi Akiva enumerated in the list here? The truth is, you could have asked the same question on the Tanakhama. It's not unique to Rabbi Akiva, because the Tanakhama also says that it would be chal, it's just you don't need hafarah here because she owns it. But technically, if she did own it, the Tanakhama doesn't think there's a problem. He just thinks you don't need to do Hafarat Nedarim because it's Batel Me'alav. But truthfully, if there wasn't a Batel Me'alav, he would have accepted the Neder going through. So the question would be just as relevant by the Tanakhama. Probably the answer is that Rabbi Akiva makes a statement explicitly. From the Tanakhama, you'd have to infer it. The reason you don't need Hafarat is because you have a Shibud on that output. And then you infer from that, that had there not been such a shibud, that it would have gone through, and if it had gone through, then davar shelo ba liolam would also be allowed by the Tanakhama. So since that's through an inference, and Rabbi Akiva is explicit in saying you need hafarah over here, the Gemara lashes on to Rabbi Akiva's shita, even though it's true of Rabbi Akiva and the Tanakhama in that Mishnah. So the question is, why isn't he included in the list? Hayit marala, you already have a qualification of that Mishnah. For a problem, the truth is, that has nothing to do with our situation, but in the end, solves the problem in our situation as well, which is, Amar Avuna Brei Rav Yeshua, Be'omeret. It's a case where she says, Yikadshu Yadai, Lo Sehem. My hands will be sanctified or holy to the Creator. Or in essence, she's Matpis, her hands to Hekdesh. Be'adayim Itnehu Ba'olam. And the hands are present here. The reason the Gemara says this in Ketubot and in other places is because of a problem in Nidarim versus Shvuot. A Shvuah can be said on something that's an intangible item. A Neder can only be taken on a tangible object. It can only make Asur a Chefetz. It can't make some intangible item Asur. A Shvuah can deal with intangible items. Over here we're talking about a Neder. If you're talking about her future production, that is an intangible item. So how could you be taking a Neder about an intangible item? The answer is that she is Makdish her hands, which are a tangible item. She basically says, my hands are Hekdesh, Lil Sam. Now, the way that she does that, and Rashi notes this, is because that it can't be that she's wholesale making her hands Asur, and that anything her hands do is then Asur, because then how does the husband get his basic amount? So what you have to say is that, Miu, b'midei d'mishabdei yadei l'baal lo matzi laktushinu. She can't be maktish her hands for things that she is obligated to give to the husband. So that same distinction still exists, and what she is saying is, my hands, which produce, will be hekdesh, or anything that my hands do are hekdesh. That's in the case where she has rights to whatever her hands do. If her hands do something that she doesn't have rights to, then she can't be, just like she can't makdish the output, she can't be makdish her hands. That won't override the fact that the husband has a shibud, because his shibud is on her hands. Just like her shibud is on the production, it's also on her hands. And therefore, she can't make that into Ekdesh. But by solving that problem by Nidarim versus Shavuot, you also solve the problem of Davar Shelo Bali Olam. Because then again, the Kinyan or whatever you're speaking about is the hands themselves and not the production of the hands. That's the result of making the hands Hekdesh. But again, by making it work for Nidarim, it also takes away this issue of Davar Shelo Bali Olam. Now there are more Tanaim that have this opinion. Gemara here is looking at a narrow list of Tanaim and saying that, that they're all Davar Echad. There must be something that drove the Gemara to bring these three Tanaim together than ask from Rabbi Akiva, rather than a broader list in Shas, where we do find there are other Tanaim that do have such an opinion. The last thing to deal with, which is this very large Tosafot over here, is the fact that in the case where we brought down Rabbi's opinion, it says, from now. Why is the Lashon of Me'achshav put in there? It's clear that the Me'achshav does not make it that it works retroactively. It's impossible here to say that Me'achshav creates a situation in which it works retroactively, because the circumstance is that he doesn't own the Eved. And then he says, gives him a commitment now, and then buys the Eved in the future, and then he's freed. So if you go say, oh, he's freed retroactively, you can't do that. Because at the time he made the commitment, it wasn't his. So that's clear that the word me'achshav here is not doing that. And so the question is, what is it doing here at all? Why is the word me'achshav relevant? Or is it maybe necessary? If you look at the top line in the Tosafot, he says, sounds like from this, that the word me'achshav is essential to working with things that are davar shelo badi olam. The big problem with that is, because the next braita that we quoted, where Rabbi Meir has that opinion, you don't see the word me'achshav mentioned once. So why is it over here we have the word me'achshav, and there you don't have the word achshav? So now you're in this bind as to what the Gemara is doing, or what the Gemara thinks when it says the word me'achshav. So Tosafot brings two answers to that problem. His first one is by the Ri. V'cheinu me'ri, delo dami. To the gabi kiddushin, anitam, delo by the Meir me'achshav. Mishum destam kiddushim bikesef. Bikinyin ma'ot lo mitpatel. He says that no, in Ochanami, you do need the word me'achshav when you use a kinyan, shedavar shelo bali olam. But the vehicle of the kinyan is also important. By kiddushin, as we said earlier, that when it comes to a kinyan kesef, the kinyan kesef, even if the kesef gets used up, the kinyan can still take effect at a later date. You can have a delayed effectiveness of the kinyan. On the other hand, if you use a shtar to generate the kiddushin, if at a later date you want it to go effective and the shtar is not there, there is no kiddushin. So what the Riz says is that in cases of kiddushin, you don't need the word machshav, because generically or generally, kiddushin are done through kesef, and therefore the kinyan will always be extant. On the other hand, if you're dealing with the buying of a slave, the freeing of a slave, there you are dealing with shtarot, since the rov kinyanim for sadeh, for property, for slaves, are shtarot. So now, if he doesn't say me'achshav, and the contract gets ripped up, or the shichrur, his commitment to free him, gets ripped up, then it wouldn't go through. So the me'achshav, in that case, overcomes that deficit. And that's what the Riz says, it's unique to that case, that we need me'achshav, because we want to preserve the kinyan, even past the point where the vehicle of the kinyan was there. So if the shtar is used, even if the shtar is not there, we want the commitment to live on. The way you do that is through using the word me'achshav. And that's relevant by shtar, it's not relevant by kesef, and that's how the Ri explains the me'achshav over here. On the other hand, the Rabbeinu Meir, Rashi's son-in-law, Perish, l'hachi naki me'achshav. This is why he needs me'achshav. Gabi sadeh ve'eved l'shmin and the savak Rabbi Meir. That he's teaching you an interesting idea, that with me'achshav would mean that the kinyan is chal immediately. Well, if the kinyan is chal immediately, we know it doesn't work because he doesn't own the slave right now. So what you would have thought is maybe because he intends for it to be me'achshav, that when he says the rest of it, we don't allow you to have it come to fruition, because we're dealing with an intangible item, or an item that it will be there in the future, that doesn't exist today. When you express the view that you want it to happen me'achshav, it's almost as if you're saying, I want it now, and not in the future. But the whole idea of a davar shelo bali olam is that it only will work in the future. So maybe that would undermine your ability to make a kinyan of davar shelo bali olam. This comes along to teach you that even when you use the word me'achshav, it does not undermine the fact that you're doing a kinyan shel davar shelo ba'olam, which is all focused on the future, and me'achshav does not ruin it. So that's the way that the Rabbeinu Meir solves the problem. He says the chiddush here is the me'achshav doesn't detract from the kinyan. On the other hand, the Ri says that it reinforces the kinyan to the point that even if you lose the object of the kinyan will still be in place. What me'achshav does, according to Ri, is preserves the ma'aseh kinyan to the point where it becomes effective. This ma'aseh will live on, even though maybe the components of the ma'aseh disappear. So that's the Ri's view. The Ramban, on the other hand, brings a third view as to why me'achshav is important over here, which is that according to Ramban, the word of me'achshav makes it that he cannot renege on the deal. When he says me'achshav, then he binds himself into this contract to the extent that he can't reverse it. If he didn't say me'achshav, since the chaluta kinyan, the effectiveness of the kinyan is delayed until he buys the actual slave, then maybe he could renege or retract his commitment to free the slave because the kinyan is not going to take a place in the future. The me'achshav makes it that it's binding from today and that you have no right to unwind it now, and your commitment is a commitment that will not be unwound. And that's why the Ramban says it's important about the me'achshav over here, which is that even though you're having a delayed effectiveness of the kinyan, this binds you to be in that position from now. It's somewhat along the lines of the Ri. You can actually combine those shitot, which some of the Rishonim do, because it's basically saying that me'achshav, according to the Ri, preserves the maseh kinyan until the time that it needs to be effective. The Ramban is saying that the me'achshav, as it says, your commitment today, even though the chalut is later, is binding at this moment. So then the Ri runs into a problem. If you say that me'achshav works, even when the get is ripped up, then we have other gemarot that seem to indicate otherwise. And then the Ri says that all of those are shita of Rabbi Yochanan, who says when you use me'achshav, uli achar, t'chloshim yom, it means that the kinyan has a duration to it, like we just saw a couple of daf ago, where he says that 100 people could have a tfisat kudushin in a single woman, because there's always a residual left in the kinyan. So according to Rabbi Yochanan's opinion, me'achshav is not going to solve your problem in these instances. But then you run into a problem, according to Rabbi Yochanan, how do we make kinyanim at all? Or how do we have these kinyanim that have duration to them, because the kinyan has to be around? And like with the kinyan sudar, where it's a moment in time, how do you preserve the kinyan to have it go effective at that later point in time? So the Rabbeinu Meir over here suggests that maybe there's a difference in the language between that which is me'achshav and that which is me'almanat. V'amar Aram, d'shem almanat mehani, afilu Rabbi Yochanan lavi shiura el tnai, l'kach tov lomar almanat me'achshav. Rabbi Yochanan's of the opinion when you say me'achshav, that there's a duration to the kinyan. Whereas maybe when you say almanat, it makes it immediate, and therefore everything that's said afterward is a tnai and condition. He wants to separate between almanat and me'achshav. And the me'achshav will work one way, and almanat will work another way. And therefore he recommends highly that you use almanat if you want to create a tnai, rather than me'achshav, which will leave the kinyan open over a period of time. Next Mishnah. Omer li sha, hariat mikudeshet li, almanat shedaber alayach lishulton. He marries her on the condition that he will lobby on her behalf with the government. Ve'aseimach kipoel, or he says, I'll work for you like a day laborer, so that she would have to pay him for that. So now the waiving of the fee to do that work, he will use as the consideration for the marriage. Diber aleh lishulton, if he goes ahead and lobbies for her, ve'aseimach kipoel, or he works for her as a day laborer, mikudeshet, then she is married. Vimlav. And if not, ena mikudeshet, they are not married. I mean that this works if he marries her with consideration, assuming that he does what he said he was going to do, because then he generates the money that is owed to the woman, and then his waiving of that fee up front is the consideration. She would have to go and hire a poel to do this work. So then, if he goes and says, I will commit to do that work for you, she now should have had to pay him. The fact that he doesn't take the pay means that he's given her something that he can marry her with. Same thing with the lobbyist. You would have to pay a lobbyist to go do this. He agrees to go be her lobbyist, so his waiving of the fee is a consideration. Now again, both cases, he has to do what he committed to do, otherwise she doesn't owe him the money and there's no consideration over here. It's not just the commitment, it's the commitment and the doing of this item that generates the fee. Now here there's a machloket. The Rambam says that it only works if he effectively succeeds in lobbying and getting what she asked for. Because that's what she wants to pay for. The Rosh, on the other hand, says, that you have to pay for a lobbyist, whether it works or not. I mean, that the whole idea is that you have someone go and beseech on your behalf to the king, or you have someone lobby the government on your behalf, whether it works or not. It's not a, right, it's a fee-based lobbying. It's not a success-based lobbying. So the Rosh says it works whether or not you succeed, because you'd have to pay for someone to do this whether they succeed or not. But Rambam, on the other hand, sees this as a success-based fee, and therefore he says that only if they succeed will it work, because that will be the consideration for the marriage. So Amar Reish Lakish, v'hu shenatan la'asha v'pruta. Reish Lakish does something that's very difficult, which basically undermines the pashut meaning of the Mishnah, and says that only if he gives her a pruta does this work, seemingly indicating that the Mishnah fails, and that he has to, along with this, give a pruta, he has to give her money, and that whatever he said in the Mishnah is amanat, is a condition, is a tanai. So the real kiddushin is generated by the pruta, and whatever is mentioned in the Mishnah is a tanai, is a condition, and he has to fulfill that condition. Then obviously, for Reish Lakish, the chiddush in the Mishnah is not the fact that when you give a pruta, you're married, and that amanat is a tanai, but the big chiddush is that if you didn't do it al tanai, but rather you did it bischar, if you did it with the fees that are generated by these items, that would not succeed. And that's the chiddush here, is that you can only do it this manner, and not in the alternate manner, or what is the pashtuta mishnah. Ubescharlo, is it really true that you can't use waived fees to generate kiddushin? That seemingly is good money to use as consideration for the marriage. Vatanya, we have a braita. Bschar, sherechav tich alachamor, he says, with the money that you owe me for giving you a donkey ride, shoshav tich bikaron, or giving you a wagon ride, obisvina, or giving you a ride on the boat, eina mikudeshet. At that point, it doesn't work, because she already owes him the money. Now, okay, if she already owes him the money, and he says, you don't have to, that money is going to be used for consideration of the marriage, seemingly that should be a good marriage. The answer is no, because that's a milveh. Once he's completed the work that he's done, and she owes him the money for the work that she's done, she's basically now on credit. And we already said that milva the hotzah nitna, that loans don't exist anymore. The money is theirs, or the credit that was extended is already gone. And now the only thing you have is an IOU, which is that I owe you the money. Waiving that IOU, or saying, with that IOU, I want to marry, you can't do that. That's a makadesh v'milva and a mikudeshet. There is a machlok, we saw this back early in the Masechta, and Davheivav, as to whether when you forgive the loan, is that enough consideration to generate a marriage? So Rashi over there said, yes, that's the case. If you forgive the loan, then that is clearly enough consideration. So if he says, you no longer owe me the money, that might be sufficient consideration to generate the marriage. But that's not what he's saying here. He's saying here, with the money that you owe me, we're getting married. That money doesn't exist anymore, and he can't marry with that consideration. It's a loan, or it's credit. She has terms with him now where she has to pay him. So now, if he waives the complete payment, maybe you can generate enough hana. That's the machlokes rishonim. But certainly, if he's trying to use the fees as the way to get the consideration for the marriage, it does not work. On the other hand, b'schar she'arkivech ala chamor, if he says, with the fees that I will generate from giving you a donkey ride, o shoshivech bikaron, o besvina, or that I will give you a ride in the wagon, or I will take you for that boat ride, that's future fees, then mikudeshet, it works. That makes sense, because now the fees don't exist yet. The fees will be earned in the future. That means that we have consideration that's coming into the world, or the money that is owed is going to be there in the future that he can use. And then when he does it and generates those fees can be then automatically, can be used for the consideration of the marriage and will not become a loan. They will become automatically the consideration. So what are you going to say, like Reish Lakish says in our Mishnah, which is a strange assumption, but by the bright, you're going to say the same thing, that not only did he promise the fees, but he gave her a pruta. Babschar kamar. Over there, it specifies that he's marrying with the fees. As opposed to our Mishnah, where it doesn't say what the consideration is for the marriage, and that's why Reish Lakish come along and say the consideration is the pruta. Over here, by the bright, it's clear that the consideration is the schar, is the fees. So you can't come along and say, oh, he gave her a pruta. That's not what the breita says. The breita says it's with the fees that he gets this. V'otanya. And we have another breita. Shevimi bitzavta v'akadesh lecha. Be a partner with me. Keep me comedy, and I will get married to you. Schok lefanai. Be a comic, or do a comedy routine in front of me. Rekod lefanai. Dance in front of me. Aseh ki dimusa zeh. Build something that looks like this building, or whatever it is that she's pointing to. Shamim. We make an assessment. If the value of the services that she is demanding were worth the Shavu Pruta, then they're married. And if not, they are not married. So again, if you would have to pay somebody to do this comedy routine or dance in front of you, a Shavu Pruta, then you would be married. If the services she's asking for are worth less than a Shavu Pruta, she would not be married. So again, are you going to give the qualification of Rabbi Reish Lakish, which says, oh, not only did she say this, but there was also a pruta given in here. The Brita says, we assess the value of the services, and that's the determining factor. So it's clear that that's what's generating the Kiddushin over here. To Yuftad Reish Lakish. These Britot are strong refutations of Reish Lakish's opinion that you add in a pruta, and that's what generates the marriage over here. Now, Amar Lecha Reish Lakish. Reish Lakish will explain to you. Hai Tana Bara, these outside Tanaim, meaning the Braitot, the authors of the Braitot, Savar, and the Schirut, El Abisof, that when you work for someone and you have a fee-based relationship, the fees are only owed at the end, once you've completed the work that you have committed to do for this individual. Why that is important is because then there's only a single point in time where the money is owed. On the other hand, Tana Didan, our Mishnah believes, Savar Yeshna Schirut Mitchila Batsof, that you earn the fees over the period of time, through the duration of the work that you do. Over that time, you then earn the money or accumulate the value that you are generating. What the difference is what is the nature of the money that is owed? If at the end of your services, that's when the money is owed, that's when it all comes due. And that's when the fee is owed. Then that means that he could marry with that schar, because that schar is exactly that. Schar, fees. On the other hand, if you earn the fees over the duration of the work that you do, that means by the time you get to the end, she's already owed you money all along. For every hour that you worked, she was already owing you money. What happened to those fees she owed you? They became credit, meaning that they are now made into a loan, because he's extending her credit. He didn't make her pay every minute along the way. He basically allowed her to accumulate the money owed till the end. And the last moment doesn't have enough of a Shavu Pruta in it, because the last moment is a minute amount, and that's only amount of fees that still exist that are not on credit. So because she's accumulating credit all along, then he's trying to be Mekadesh B'milveh. And that'll be the difference. The Tanaim of the Bright don't believe that Schirut is earned at a single point of time in the end. Since it's at that single point of time in the end, those fees can be used as consideration for the marriage, because there is no halva'a over here. It's not a mekadesh v'milveh. On the other hand, our Mishnah believes that the schirut is mitchila v'atzof, and therefore you're accumulating the fees owed over here, and you're generating credit all along, and then you're trying to be mekadesh v'milveh, that doesn't work. In a case where he gave her a shavu pruta, what pushed or pressured Reish Lakish to set up our Mishnah in such a difficult manner? The easy answer to that question is because Reish Lakish believes that that's a halacha. Halacha is that schirut is mitchila v'atzof, and therefore he wanted the Mishnah to corroborate what he is saying. So that's why he set up the Mishnah that way. But the Gemara doesn't seemingly accept that. We'll have to explain why. Amarova matznitan kashite. The Mishnah was difficult for him. Ma'iria datani almanat. Why does it say in our Mishnah almanat on condition? Nitnei bischar. It should have said bischar. I mean, like the Braita, which says that the consideration is the fees, and it says it explicitly, bischar. Why does our Mishnah use the lashon of almanat, which is conditional? Elishmamina, kol almanat, hechi deyayiv lahu. When it comes to almanat, almanat only works when he gave her something else. Because almanat means that's a condition, it's not the consideration. And therefore, what Reish Lakish says is that almanat takes this out of the consideration for consideration, and makes it that is a tnai. That is a requirement to have the kedushin go effective, but it is not the kedushin itself. So then what is the kedushin here? The answer is that that's the pruta. And that's what drove Reish Lakish to do this. So again, we said that the real reason it drove Reish Lakish driven to do that is that because that's his opinion. And he would rather have the Mishnah abide by that. But the truth is that he already has two braitot that say otherwise. And the simpler way to explain the Mishnah would be along the lines of the braitot. So that would not have been necessarily a compelling enough reason, because we have other Mishnayot and Shas, he has other support from Tanaim, that there is this concept of Yesh, now the Skirut Mitchila itself. So why would you create explanation in a Mishnah, which is so difficult, when you could just simply say the Mishnah follows the Braita, and I just don't hold like that. That would have been just as equally palatable to Reish Lakish. So the answer is that he saw the problem in the Mishnah, which is that he used the Lashon of Almanat instead of Bischar, and that drove him to say that the Mishnah is not made a condition, so where is the consideration? It must be that is a pruta that was given. Now once he's done that, then the Mishnah also happens to abide by his position that Yesh Neschirot Mitkhla Atzof. And that's why the Mishnah said it was an Almanat, it was a Tanai, and it was not the consideration for the marriage. Okay, now, the next Mishnah, which is really a continuation of the previous Mishnah, it's just new scenarios. Almanat she irtze abba, on the condition that my father will acquiesce to the marriage. Ratzav mikudeshet. If the father acquiesces, then the marriage goes through, meaning that he gets the final say as to whether the marriage is effective. Bimlav, and if he doesn't, ain't a mikudeshet. If he doesn't approve it, then the marriage does not go through. Meitav, the father passes away. Harizo mikudeshet. Then the marriage goes through. What seemingly the Mishnah is saying here is that the father's death is the equivalent of approval, because he can no longer disapprove of it. So that is effectively approving of the marriage. So meita ben, blamdim av lomar sheinu rotze. If the son passes away, then we teach the father to say that he disapproves of the marriage. Not because necessarily he did or didn't disapprove of it, but his disapproval will unwind the marriage retroactively and free her from yibum, or having a problem of yibum, because otherwise the woman's bound in a situation where there's no reason to put her into a yibum in a case where he could free her by simply saying that the marriage never happened. My amanat shirtze abba. I'll ask your question, which is, what exactly was the formulation here of the condition that says when my father approves? Ilema damar abba in. Does that mean that we need active affirmation? Which is that when your father says yes, it works. In all likelihood, the ability to make that positive affirmation would be limited to the time that he hears it. But there are those, like the Ramban, who brings an alternate view that the in, or the positive affirmation here means anytime that he gave positive affirmation, that would be the case. The deficit or difficulty with that is then, even in the cases like the Seifa, where we tell him to reject it, if he has the ability then later on to say yes, then his rejection is not meaningful. So that's why it favors saying that the positive affirmation has to be at the time that he gets the information or hears about the information. Ema mitziota. Then what do you do with the middle section of the Mishnah? Meita av. If the father passes away, azay mukudeshet. They're automatically married. Ziva lo amar in. He never said or never made that affirmative statement of yes. Wait a minute. Didn't you say that we need positive affirmation? If he's passed away, there is no positive affirmation that's going on. His death is not a positive affirmation. It's just a lack of rejection. Ella, it must be amanat shishto. As long as my father remains silent, then we're okay. And as long as he remains quiet about this, then we are fine. So ema seifa. Then he would do the last piece of the Mishnah, which says, meita ben, when the son passes away, melamin met av lo mar sheinu rotze. Then we make the father state explicitly that he doesn't want it. Amai, why does he have to state he doesn't want it? Vashotik, he was silent. So as long as he was silent, then we are good to go because he did not reject it. So Tolda Yishanim says that it can't be a scenario here where Malamdim and Av is coming to tell you that he didn't hear about it. And therefore we're now telling him about it, and that's what it means, Malamdim and Av, because he hadn't heard of it. Now that he heard of it and he was silent, that will be his acquiescence. So he rejects that understanding and says that it's clear here from the Gemara that the father already had heard about it and was silent. And that's why the Gemara is rejecting that as a possibility of explanation in that case, because if he was silent already when he heard about it, there's nothing more to discuss about Malamdinoto, that we have to teach him anything. Now, embedded in this, and we're going to see this in a second, is that Almanat Shishtok means that at that point in time when he gets the news. I mean, that it's not that he has to remain silent for the rest of his life, it just means at the point when he finds the information, if he is silent at that point, then we say that the Kedushin go through, or everything that happens. He doesn't have to do anything. He just has to be silent when he gets the information. On the other hand, the Gemara is going to introduce now a third possibility, which is Shelo Yimache, that he won't reject it. In that case, that is something that he could do. It's an open-ended case, which is, anytime he decides he wants to reject it, that would reject the Kedushin. The reason that they're saying that is because that Shtika is a single moment in time. Because can't be a case with the shtika forever, because then you don't need lo yimacheh. Then shtika and lo yimacheh are identical or synonymous. There is a shita like that, but it's clear that the Tosafot and the Tosafot Yishanim are rejecting that. So you have here three different scenarios. One is where we want positive affirmation from the father. Positive affirmation would mean that he'd have to speak up. He'd have to do something in order for the condition to go through. We have another one, which is shtika. Now, shtika is that he has to simply do nothing. But he has to do nothing at the point that he hears it. It's not that he has to do nothing for the rest of his life. As long as at the time that he gets the information, he is silent, there his silence is acquiescence. There's a third possibility, is that my father doesn't reject the kiddushin. And there you open it up to him speaking actively in order to reject it, but you gave no time frame for that. Which means that as long as the father rejects it any time in his lifetime, then the marriage will be dissolved. Because of that, if you do such a thing, retroactively, it will be dissolved. Because of that, you can't marry the woman until the father passes away. Once the father has passed away, you can no longer reject it, then you can marry the woman because that possibility is taken out of circulation. That the case is a case where he says that my father doesn't reject it. Reisha b'chadtaima, umitziyata v'seifa b'chadtaima. So, seemingly, what the solution to this problem is that we are interpreting the words of the Mishnah over here when it says, Almanacha Erze Abba, we're interpreting those to mean something different in the Reisha versus the Seifa and the Mitziyata and the Seifa. This is Girsat Rashi. You should just know, we're not going to spend time or explain it. There is an alternate Girsa that reads, Reisha Mitziyata Bechad Taima and Seifa Bechad Taima. The Mitziyata case can be explained according to either of these two languages, which is, I'll just explain that now, which is that when the father passes away, if you either demand shtika, then he's gone, and there's a shtika, there's an automatic shtika, because he can't speak anymore. Right? If you demand it, shalom yimacheh, that he won't reject it, he can no longer reject it because he's not alive. So the explanation of the mitziyato is equally plausible under both of these scenarios. And that's why you have a machloket in the girsa as to which side the mitziyata falls. Rashi's girsa makes more sense only because the mitziyata and seifa are similar cases. One's a case where the father dies, one's a case where the son dies. So it would make more sense to put those two together and leave the reisha separately. But I'm just making you aware of the other girsa and why the mitziyata doesn't matter. Now, with the reisha case says, if he wants it, it works. So what does that mean that he wants it? So the way Rashi explains it is that he said, as long as Abba is silent. What is it that he wants from the father? He wants the father to acquiesce. Silence is acquiescence. As long as he's silent, the time he gets the information, that's Sheretz Abba. Now we're in a good situation. Now with regards to the Seifa, Meta Ben, the son dies, why do we need the father to actively do something now? That is because he said, as long as my father does not reject it. So that was the statement in the, according to Rashi, the Mitziyata and the Seifa. So here, where the father comes along and rejects it, he's able to unwind the Kiddushin. And that's why the Beit Din says to him, speak up. Because if you reject it now, you will change the Chalut HaKiddushin. Reisha b'chad taima mitziyata v'seifa b'chad taima Rabbi Yanai. In, Rabbi Yanai says yes. That is the way to explain the Mishnah, and that is to interpret the words Yirtzeh as meaning these different things. Although we are redefining what Almanach Yirtzeh means in the Mishnah, when it actually comes to what the person stated, then they actually stated it. They didn't say Almanach Yirtzeh Abba, they literally said Ad Shelo Yimacheh or Ad Sheyomar Kein, meaning that he explicitly said it. The Mishnah just writes it Almanach Yirtzeh, and then we're interpreting what that means. The actual tznai that is instituted by the son is based on the language that we're picking over here. It's not saying, I'm not sure it's in, and we're interpreting his language. That's only with regards to the Mishnah. Whatever we say that the Mishnah means, that's what he actually said. Amar Reish Lakish, Shmamina. From this you would conclude that the Rabbi Yanai, Dachkinan umekmina matinta mitrei taima valib dechatana. He'd much rather have a single author of the Mishnah rather than have multiple authors of the Mishnah. Which is that the alternative would be say that this Mishnah is an amalgamation of different opinions. And the opinions have different views about what is Almanach Yirtzeh Abba over here. That would be another way to explain the Mishnah. And he prefers to say, no, it's all authored by the same person, but the Mishnah means different things. In the different sections of the Mishnah, we're going to explain differently what Almanach Yirtzeh Abba is. But he does not want to have it to be two authors with the same tam. Meaning that you say this terminology, what does this terminology mean? The fact that Rabbi Yanai favors reinterpreting the Mishnah in the different sections shows you that he prefers to have a single Tana with different interpretations of the same wording within the Mishnah and saying it means this here, it means that there, He'd rather do that than have two Tanaim saying about the same wording, having different opinions about what that wording means or what is the meaning of that wording. Happens to be that the Gemara explicitly speaks about that in the Gemara Baba Metzia on a Mishnah. There, the Gemara speaks about the fact that there were two Amoraim, and the Amoraim are fighting about exactly that issue, which is, which do we prefer? Would we rather have the Mishnah authored by multiple authors, or would we rather have the Mishnah be consistent in authorship, but give it different explanations of the wording or the meaning of words in that Mishnah? That's an approach to Mishnah. And you could understand that because, remember, Rabbi is creating the Mishnayot, and he's doing that by bringing together opinions. He doesn't always tell us who the opinion is. He's bringing you a stump. So sometimes it could be that he's bringing opinions from different places or different Tanaim. That's one way to argue it. Or you can say that even though it's a single Tana, bringing it together from different places, and therefore the wording in the context of one place and the context of the other place was different or meant something different. When he brings them together, it looks strange, but the truth is that they have different meanings, and that's okay. That's the argument here, is about fundamentally, how do you deal with Mishnayot that have these problems in them? Would I rather say that there's dual authorship? Or would I rather say that a single word can have dual meaning, and I'd rather go that way and keep the authorship consistent? Basically asking, what do you think Rabbi did when he put the Mishnayot together? Did he keep the authorship consistent? Or did he keep the meaning of the words consistent? What is it that he was focused on, and what was sacrificed in order to do that? Yosef Barami Amar Deolam Chataymahu. It's all the same reasoning. My almanachi or te'aba. What does it mean that my father will agree to this? Almanach lo yimeche aba mikan vat 30 yom. The fact that my father will not reject it for 30 days. Now, as soon as you put in the time constraint, then you've dealt with the issue. Because then the 30-day window expires, and then automatically there is a no rejection by the father because he's expired the time in which he could give that rejection. So by putting a time limit on it, you solve that problem. So that's what he does. Obviously, there's a concession here as well. Rabbi Yosef Barami is saying, look, I can get it all to mean one thing, but he's adding in information that doesn't exist in the Mishnah, which is there's a time limit put on it. By adding that time limit, he solves it, gives it one authorship and the same meaning throughout the Mishnah. But he does that at the expense of adding in information that doesn't exist in the Mishnah. So Tosfot asks a question here. Vim tomar, mechad meit kodem hashmia. The fact that the father died before he got the information, heyachi mikudeshet. How is she merrier? Dilma lo abashama. Had he heard the information, he would have rejected it. There's a distinct possibility over here that the father passes away without ever knowing the information about the marriage. So in that case, how do we make a presumption or an assumption that the father would have agreed to it? It's one thing if he heard it and then didn't say anything and then he dies, because then we've terminated his right and he had the information. But in a case where he never had the information, how do we know what the father's reaction would have been? And that's the most important thing here. What is the father's reaction? That's what says that we have to assume here that our feeling was that he wouldn't reject it. And therefore, we just extend that, or we solidify that assumption once he's passed away, even though he never heard about it. So he says, why is the Gemara ask over here? He didn't say yes. Why does he have to actually give positive affirmation if we're assuming that he probably was positively inclined towards this marriage anyway? Why don't we make the same assumption like we say that he didn't reject it, that he probably wouldn't have rejected, say the same thing with a positive affirmation. He probably would have said yes. So he makes a fundamental distinction between silence and positive affirmation. By positive affirmation, we cannot make assumptions about what he would have said. Even if we know, or we think we know what he would have said, if we don't have the positive affirmation, you can't just say it would have been positively affirmed. In the case where you need simple silence, that we can make assumptions about because he would have had to done nothing. And he's doing nothing. So we can then extend, or we can overlay on that what we think he would have done in this situation, which was to remain silent. So what we are saying is basically that when you require a commission, then we need you to actively do it and we can't make assumptions. When we require omission, then we can make assumptions about what you would have done, and then it would have worked. And that's a very key distinction in having this all work, or the difference between positive affirmation versus lack of rejection of the marriage over here. Kidashit viti, veni yodea lami kidashtia. I married my daughter off, just won't remember the lucky guy who married her. Ba'achad v'amar ani kidashtia. I'm him. I'm the guy that you married her off to. Neman, he is believed. Zeamar anikidashtiya, zeamar anikidashtiya. Now he runs into the problem. Two guys show up and say that we're the ones that you chose. We're the ones who are going to marry her. Shnehem notnim get. They both have to give divorces to her because we don't know which one to believe over the other. Vimratzu echad noten get vechad kones. If one wants to give her a get, a divorce, and the other one wants to marry her, we're just as happy with that because then as long as we've taken one of the parties out of the picture, the other party can marry her. All right, so now, Amar Rav Nachman. Ne'eman liten get ve'ein ne'eman lichnos. What Rav says is, the ne'emanut in the Mishnah is that he's ne'eman to give her a get. What he's not ne'eman to do is to marry her. Ne'eman liten get in adam chutev lo. Person doesn't sin to the benefit of another party. When he gives a get over here, he's not the beneficiary of anything. He gives the get, she's divorced. What he does do is benefit her to marry someone else. So his coming up and claiming he's the guy and giving her a get, if he's lying, then he's basically being chuteh to benefit another party who can marry her in the future. So we have a principle that people sin for their own benefit. People sin when they are the beneficiary of that infraction. But they don't do things wrong or they don't have infractions to protect someone else or to make someone else's life better. On the other hand, he's not believed to marry her. Ema Yitzro Tokfo. Over there, he has a vested interest in saying, I'm the guy. When he comes in and says, I'm the guy, and he gets to marry this woman, maybe he wants to marry this woman. Maybe he desires this woman. So he is claiming that he's the guy. Over there, we can be suspect about his motives for declaring that he is the individual. Ravasi Amar Afne Manichnos. Ravasi disagrees and says that he is believed to marry her. Umode Ravasi, but Ravasi agrees. But Omeret Nitkadashti, Veni Yodata Mi Nitkadashti. If the woman herself says, I accepted Kiddushin, I just don't know who I accepted it from. Ba'achad Vamar Kiddashti, and then a guy comes on and says, I married her. She'ein Ne'eman Lichnos. Then there is no Ne'emanut for them to get married. The next section of the Gemara will explain why. There's a difference between the father and the daughter. It's not our Mishnah. Ratzu Echad Noten Get Ve'Echad Kones. Our Mishnah says explicitly that one of them can give a get, the other one can marry her. And it's not enough here that the other guy's giving the get to allow him to get married to this woman, because you could say that the principle of En Adam Chotev Lo Lo is only in a case where the guy thinks that he's going to free her to the world. But over here, when he knows there's another guy declaring that he's the husband, he doesn't think anything bad's going to come out of it. So he says, yeah, why not give her a get? So that's why over there, the fact that he's giving a get here is not enough for us to believe the other guy and say that he should be able to marry her. And that's why the Gemara is searching for a way for Rav to explain the Mishnah, even though seemingly it's self-explanatory because one guy gave a get and he's basically declaring the other guy as to be the one who was married to her. To Yufta the Rav. That's a strong refutation of Rav's position here that you can't marry. Here the Mishnah clearly says you can marry. Amar lecha Rav, Shani Otam, the Kaven de Ika Acher Badei, Irtute Mirtat. The case in our Mishnah is unique because there are two parties that are coming here. He's at risk. If he shows up and says, I'm the guy, and another guy shows up and says, I'm the guy, he's at high risk that the father's going to figure out that which one of them it was or that it was the other guy. So it's too risky an endeavor over there for him to play games. And so therefore, when he says, I'm the guy, then we believe him that he is the guy. Even though the other guy's giving a get, which means that we kind of believe him as well. But nevertheless, in that situation, there's enough tension in the situation to say that he'd be telling the truth. But in a case where he's the only guy who shows up, then the father has no way to discern between them or think, oh yeah, there was this guy or that guy. There, we don't allow him to marry the woman. Tanya Kavoti de Ravasi, we have a bright that supports Ravasi's position, and here we're going to get the explanation for Ravasi's position. Kidashti et biti, v'en yodea nami kidashtia. I married off my daughter, but I have no idea who I married her off to. Uba echad v'amar kidashtia. Another guy shows up and says, I'm the guy. Afne man lichnos. The Mishnah says explicitly he is believed to marry her. Kansa ubacher. If he marries her and then someone else shows up, Amar ani kidashtia. I'm the one who married her. Lo kolay menu lo sralav. The second guy has no rights to override or undermine the kiddushin of the first one. The first guy came. They accepted him as being the party that was the kiddushin with. That means the marriage is now consummated. We found the one that she's married to. Some other guy comes and casts aspersions on it. We're not going to worry about that. Even if he says, I'm the guy, we say, no, we already decided who the guy was. You are not relevant. The woman says, I got married to someone. I don't know who I got married to. And when one guy comes along and says, I'm the one that married you. Because she covers up for him. So here's the answer to the question as to why Rav Asi makes a distinction between the father and the daughter, which is that by the daughter, she's in an embarrassing situation, which is that she accepted Kiddushin from someone and she has no idea who that person is. If a guy shows up and says, I'm the guy, she has a vested interest in having this go through basically to solve her problem. This will bring a solution to her problem now. And now she has a marriage and she will cover up. Even if he's not the real guy, she'll basically say he is the guy in order to rectify the problem or to get herself out of this bind. Because otherwise, again, she's in an embarrassing situation, a difficult situation. This solves the problem. So she'd be willing to cover up the whole situation, say he's the guy, just to get out of the situation. And so therefore we don't believe him in order to marry her, because she will just say yes, that's the guy, because that benefits her to say yes in this situation. On the other hand, for the father, we have what's called mirtat ritute. The guy is not going to show up and make a declaration to the father, thinking that the father is going to say, yeah, yeah, that was the guy. Right? Because the father is, first of all, a third party here, in some sense, it's not the daughter, even though he's also in a difficult bind. It's not as difficult a bind because he's not the direct party to this situation. So because of that, he will be more discerning. Because he'll be more discerning, parties that come in and declare themselves as the suitor will be afraid to do it unless they really are telling the truth. They know they may get caught by the father. So it all has to do with the psychology of the person coming and saying, I'm the one. If they believe that the other party is not going to say anything and just going to accept it, then they're willing to lie because they know they're not going to get caught in the lie. So by the case of the woman where there's a high likelihood she'll say yes, no matter what, just to solve the problem and to get out of the situation, then psychologically they'll come in and lie because they know she'll cover up for them. And then with the father, even if they're just uncertain as to whether he'll reject it, that's enough of a deterrent that they won't come in and lie to get married because they know they're going to get caught if the father rejects them. That's enough psychologically to block people from doing it unless they're telling the truth. Now, even though in general by erva we would require ein davar she'erva pachot mishnayim, so how are we believing this guy over here to say he's the guy to go marry her? The reason is because over here he's not going against the chazaka, but rather reinforcing the chazaka. When do we say that ein davar be'erva she'pachot mishnayim is when you're trying to change the status of the individual. Over here, the status of this woman is an eish hadish. And you're coming along and saying, I'm the one who's married to her, is just reinforcing that she's an eish hadish. Just happens to be that the eish hadish is with you and not with someone else. So over there, we give nemanut to the one individual, even in B'makom Erva, because you're not changing the chazak or the status of the woman. So even though by the case of the get, where he is changing her status, we have the reasoning of Ein Adam Chote V'lo Lo, but why does that overcome the deficit of Eid HaNechan is not Neman by Davar Sheberva? And what you'll have to say is that because at first he's going with the chazaka and declaring himself the husband, then later when he brings the get, he's just unwinding something where he was flowing with the chazaka. Once he's the husband, then he can unwind the get. Okay, Yibai Lahu. Ma'oli skola yodo. Do we now kill her based on this? Meaning that the father here has nemanut, according to Rav, at least to allow for the get over here. For Rav Asi, enough nemanut to say she was married. When the guy shows up, we believe and they get married. Does the father have enough nemanut to say that she is an arusa now? And if she's an arusa and has an extramarital affair, do we say now that she'll be put to death based on that? Even though it's not mukhrach that this gemara is connected to the previous gemara, and it's the same scenario, and the gemara here is just bringing the machloket Rav and Rav Asi, which is a similar type of machloket over here, you could easily connect between the two and say that the question is about the father saying that he married her off to a certain individual, and he doesn't know who that individual is. Does he have nemanut in that instance to say that the person she had the extramarital affair with is certainly not the individual that he married her off to? Or you could explain it simply, does he have nemanut with regards to saying that this girl is married, and he might even be able to identify for us who the person is? And now the question is, does he have nemanut in that case to say that I accepted Kiddushin on her behalf in order to punish her? And it's independent of the cases before. Again, you could read there either way. Samokhrach, although I would lean in favor of saying that it's probably connected to the previous cases, because that would make the flow of the Gemara, the continuum of the Gemara, much smoother. Now the reason we're saying this is because the parshia where the father gets that nemanu from is the parshia of an arusa, motzi shemra. There the parshia says, et biti natati li ishazeh. I gave my daughter to this individual. Which means the father is given nemanu to say that he married his daughter off to a particular individual. How far does that nemanut go? Does that nemanut only the case where he can point to the guy and say who I married her off to, and that's when he's believed? Or is that believability even extend to a case like in our Mishnah where he gives you a generic answer that they're married without any specifying who the individual is? So Rav Amar ein soklin. Rav says no skila. Obviously Rav is consistent over here. He, number one, says it's enough to get a get, but he's not neman to allow them to get married. And there's no nemanut again for skila. So he doesn't believe the guy who shows up and claims that he's the guy. He doesn't believe the father enough to allow for skila. I mean, Rav is very circumspect about this situation and says that we believe you only in the case for the get. But other than that, we're not going to believe you. Now then, Rav Asi Amar Soklin. Rav Asi, who believes the husband who shows up and says, I'm the guy, also believes the father to say that she was married off. Rav Amar Ein Soklin Ki Hem Nei Rachman Ola'av Li Isura. When the Torah believes the father, et bitin atak le'isha zeh, that is only by Isurim. Isurim, the get can get rid of. The katlo lo emne, to put her to death, there he doesn't have that type of nemanut. Rabasi Amar Soklim, the kula milte emne, rachman ola'av. The fathers believe both to generate an Isur that would demand a get over here, as well as to put her to death if she has an extramarital affair, and the father says that wasn't the guy that I married her off to. And that would be enough to make her into an arusa in that case. Amar Ravasi. Ravasi says about his own opinion, Umodina be'omeret nitkadashti she'en soklim. That if she's the one who makes that declaration, then there is no skila. So Ravasi is somewhat consistent with his opinion before, which is that when it's the father involved, then we say that the suitor also has nemanut over there. Whereas when it is the case where it's the woman involved, the suitor's not believed. Now similarly, Rav Asi has the same opinion with regards to the father and the daughter. The father's neman to say that she's married, even if he can't specify the individual, and enough to put her to death for that. On the other hand, the woman herself is not believed in that case. Rav Asi, Hainishmata didan mirafsan igre. What I said over here breaks the roofs, or shatters the roofs of the houses, because it's seemingly illogical. If we're going to believe the father, why won't we believe the daughter? If she says she's married, why won't we believe that she's married? In a case by the father, where if the suitor comes and says that I'm the guy, we allow her to get married, Amart Soklim, and nevertheless we say that the father's believed enough to put her to death, Makom Shim Balichnos Enkonel Kones, in the case here where the suitor shows up and it's the woman who says that I got married, we don't allow them to get married because we worry about the woman here, but we believe there's Kiddushin, we just don't believe who the guy is. Ain't Udinsha so clean? Then certainly over there we should stone because we believe the Kedushin are good enough to block even a guy who's showing up and saying, I'm the suitor. Velohi. He's saying about his own opinion. That's the wrong way to look at it. La'av hemne rachmana l'dida lohemna. The Torah believes the father. The Torah does not believe the daughter or the woman herself. The Torah says, et bitina tata l'isha zeh. He has nemanut. That he is granted. The daughter is not granted that nemanut. So therefore she's not believed. Then why does she need a get over here? So Rashi explains that for us. When it comes to a death penalty, we don't put people to death because of a chashash, because we are worried that something happened over here. Ulinyan isura, taima achrino. And by isura, it's a different reasoning. Tishavita lenafsha chaticha di isura. She basically made herself into something asur. Vailo mirtat, mibneshi mechapa alav, legabiav mirtat. And therefore, the kiddushin generates an isur, not because of this nemanut issue. It generates a isur because she's made herself into something that is a sur. She's basically saying, I'm married. She says she's married. It's the equivalent of saying, I'm an avela. I am a chelev. You can't eat me, right? You can't marry me because I'm married already. That she is believed because eidecha neman b'isurin, and therefore she can generate an isur. That we allow to go through. Now, how do we deal with that isur? That's the difference between the father and the daughter as to what we think the psychology of the suitor is going to be. By the father, where there's mirtat, we say we can overcome the problem of a chaticha isura. We can overcome that problem because there is a deterrent for lying, and since there's a deterrent for lying, we believe him that he is the guy. By the woman, where there is no deterrent, we're going to say she made herself into chaticha of isura, and she can't solve the problem by simply saying this is the guy. She's no longer neman in that situation because she has a vested interest in going through, or, in essence, the other guy doesn't fear lying because she will cover up the lie. And therefore, that won't overcome the problem of a chaticha shel isura. But by death penalties, that's nemanut. Nemanut was only granted to the father. It was not granted to the daughter. Rav Chisda Amar, Echad Zeh V'Echad Zeh Ein Suklin. Rav Chisda disagrees and says, no skila here. Doesn't matter the father, doesn't matter the daughter, there is no skila over here. V'az de Rav Chisda L'Tameh, and Rav Chisda goes to Shitoto. Dom Rav Chisda, B'ni Zeh Ben Teisha Shanim V'Yom Echad, B'ti Zo Bat Gimel Shanim V'Yom Echad. If a parent declares, a father declares about his son that he's 9 years in one day, or his daughter that she is 3 years in one day, he's believed to force the counterparty to have to bring a korban bishogeg, but he cannot bring them to the point of punishment, that they will get killed, or that they will be punished in any way. The definition of makot v'onshin, pashtu would mean makot means malkot, and onshin would be mita. You can see here in the Tosfot Yeshanim that he gives an alternative explanation, which is makot or makot madut, which is our makot midrabanan for someone who violates an avera, but we don't have a deem or we don't have a tera, we're missing some technical piece to it, but we know they violated the avera. Onshim are where we have a deem vatera, and the person is actually going to get punished. What we're speaking about here is arayot. In case of arayot, there is an erva that engaged intimately with this individual's son or daughter. The culpability of the party that engaged with them is set by their age, which is that a child 9 years and one day of age is already biato bia. If that's the case, an erva that engages with them is chayav mita, or is subject to the penalties of parashat kedoshim. On the other hand, if he's younger than 9 years and one day, biato en bia, then they're not subject to those punishments. Same thing with the girl. As long as she's over the age of 3 years and one day, they'll be subject to punishment of the Parshat Arayot. Now, that means that the father is a linchpin in this situation because he determines whether these people are culpable or not by declaring the age of his child. So what Rav Chisda says is he's believed to give their ages to force them to bring korbanot. If it was done by Shogeg, then he can force them to bring korbanot based on his testimony. What he can't do with his testimony is bring them to mita or bring them to a punishment. And so that's Rav Chisda L'Tameh, which says that the father has ne'manut to a point, but he doesn't have ne'manut to bring them to the point of mita or to punishment. Tanya kavati de Rav Chisda. We have a braita that supports Rav Chisda's contention here, which is basically that ne'manut with regards to age of children is limited to allowing for korbanot, but it does not involve onshin. And the same would be true here in our case where the father says, I married this girl off. And now we want to be sukel, we want to stone her for that based on her being having an extramarital affair. He doesn't have the right to make such declarations about his daughter that will result in punishments. That he doesn't have the right to do. And that's what Rav Chisda would disagree with Rav Asi over here, more like along the lines of Rav, but different than Rav. Rav says the father has no nemanut at all. On the other hand, Rav Chisda believes that the father has nemanut, but only to a point. It doesn't include punishment. So now, the Gemara says we have a bright that supports Rav Chisda's contention, B'ni Zeh, Ben Yud Gimel Shana V'Yom Echad, B'ti Zo, Bat Yud Bet Shana V'Yom Echad. My son is Bar Mitzvah, my daughter is a Bat Mitzvah, Neman. And so even though he's a Karov here, he's not testifying about their infraction, he's testifying about their age. That has ramifications with regards to the infraction, but it's not testimony that is directed about the chait where they would be pasul. It's about their ages, which then has ramifications to it. And that's why they're believed here, because of Eidecha Neman Bisurim. What is he Neman about? L'nidarim, l'charamim, u'lehekdeshot. A nether is to face once a child is already of age. So now if he declares their age, the nether will be to face. L'charamim, those are dedications to Berek Abayit, to Hekdesh. Again, they're similar to Nidarim. Oleg deshot, and these are direct items that he's being makdish, or she's being makdish. In all those cases, he makes them, or will deem them to be of age, to be bound by whatever happens over here. Olarachin, if they declare that they're going to give their erech to Hekdesh. And even though by Nidarim we have the fact that a muflas amoch deish, even when they haven't reached the age of 13 or 12, a year before that, we assume that their Nidarim are toface, that's only when they understand the Nidarim. But once they come of age, even if they don't really understand the Darim, they are bound by their word at that point in time. So their testimony of the father has impact here in terms of their age as to whether they have to really understand what they're doing. Or once they're of age, we just assume that they know what they're doing. Unless they're a shoteh, they're bound by their word or by their neder that they have taken. Avalo, the makot, vonshin. But for punishments, that would not be the case. So over here, in the other case, it was punishments of other individuals. But over here, it's talking about punishments of them themselves. He does not have the right to come along and declare them of age to be punished. So therefore, their age will not be determined by the parent. He's Naaman to tell you the age, but he's not Naaman to tell you the age for that to result in a punishment. Now Rashi over here says something very interesting. Rashi says, "Lina don shin shekol mitzvot imiviu shtei sarot simanhu." Variam gedolim lechol davar. Once they have reached the age of puberty, and the father declares them over that age, then they are considered to be of age. And therefore they're bound by all these items. But the other side of this, which is Rashi says, Avalola makot, lachzik se'arutayem b'cheskat siman lukot ulanish. On the other hand, the father doesn't have a right to declare that they're reaching a puberty is really at the time of being an age, and that this siman is a real siman. What Rashi is discussing is that if a child reaches puberty before coming of age, our assumption is that it's not really puberty, it's a shuma. It's some sort of birthmark, it's a growth that's there, it's not really puberty. So the age is essential in determining whether the se'arot that we have here is really puberty or is something else. So the father's declaration, according to Rashi, is that determining factor, which is that the father's declaration tells us whether the shtei se'arot we're seeing here are puberty, or the shtei se'arot over here are seeing here are shuma, and the father is the determining factor. So he has believability with regards to these items. He does not have believability with regards to makot and unshin. That's the way Rashi reads this. Tosafot has difficulty with this, because he says, V'kasha, dim kein kol anashim abot lefaneinu lachlotz, heich yachlotzu, af agav sheyesh lem simanim, kimin shanu yodim, shnoteim, lomani. But he goes, how can we perform chalitza for women that come in front of us? Or even if the husband's there, how is it possible we perform chalitza? We don't know the age of the husband, we don't know the age of the woman. How do we know that there really is a need for chalitza, or chalitza is proper over here? We might be dealing with a katan, we might be dealing with a ktana. How do we know to do chalitza? Tell me, puberty? Puberty, according to Rashi, is not a significant enough sign. You need puberty and age for it to be significant enough. So how is Beit Din ever going to know what to do? He says, V'chol anashim abayim al arayot, eichein niragim. How do we kill anybody for engaging with an illicit relationship? Because we don't know if they were of age. They might reach puberty, but we still don't know if they reach the age that is the case. So Marie, di'ika ribo yisarot, samchinan aribo yisarot, den darkam lavo kodem yugim oshana. Inami, imeim godolim bekoma, yesh lishmoch al simanim vakoma. What the Rebbe says is that there are physical features that indicate to us age. That we only have a safek about puberty when we're talking about shtei sarot, two hairs. Then we're trying to determine, is that puberty or is that a shuma? On the other hand, once the overwhelming existence of sarot are there, it's clear that someone only has that amount of sarot when they've crossed over that age threshold. Or there's a physical stature, which is that the physical stature plus puberty together would indicate to us that they are of age. So what the Rebbe says is that we use circumstantial evidence with the saro to make sure that we can determine that the age without testimony from someone else. In that way, you could explain Rashi's version here, which is that there is a threshold where we will make determinations that it's person's growing gray in their hair, gray in their beard. Okay, we know that they are already of age. Either there are other physical signs that can corroborate puberty, and therefore you don't have to worry about it. So that's how he will explain it to get out of all of these problems. I was thinking that there's some kids that are very tall, so their physical features present in a way that makes them look older, or they're short, and so it looks like that they're younger. So you have to be careful. You have to use a collection of evidence to indicate what the age of that individual is. But he says you could come to that conclusion even without the testimony of someone else, and then that's why they'd be subject to punishment. Inami, he gives another answer, which goes, Od perishri, shita acheret makom simanim, em tzerich edut shanim. If we have simanim, if you have puberty, we don't need the age thing. So then what do we need the father at all? Meaning that if puberty works without the father, then what do we need the father to tell us that they're of age now? Because the real factor is, had they reached puberty? What does it matter that the father tells us that they are 13 or not 13? That doesn't have any impact over here. That he was already of age when he did these things. So that the father is believed to retroactively make a statement about the child to say that what they've been doing until now, they've already came of age 2 years ago, 3 years ago. So the father can make that declaration. That's what the Nemanut is for. For punishment, we won't believe them. So what the Reed says is that the Nemanut of the father is good retroactively for certain items, but not for punishment. As far as the determination of the age of the child, the father's irrelevant. If we have Simanim, if we have puberty, then we're fine. We don't need the father anymore. The father's only relevant when we're trying to do things in a retroactive manner to figure out, he did this in the past, was he of age when he did that? And there, the father's testimony will matter, going only for certain items, not for punishment. So that's another explanation of the Re, that frees you of all this problem, which says that we don't need the father and puberty to make someone or declare someone of age, and then we don't run all these problems of how we figure out that all these people are of age, because they're of age, because they hit puberty, that's it. Age is another factor, and that's all has to do with what we want to know if things in the past, how old were they? Were they already reached puberty at that time? I mean, that's things that the father can testify about. St. Tosfot over here says, Neman l'nidarim. Fathers believe that the guards are nidarim. So when it says, Deidachad neman b'isurin. When it comes to isurin, we have an Eidachad that's neman. Tema, ha ein neman, el devar shbiyado. We only say that things are your neman about things that are in your control. Veshlamar came into sofuli gadel, asuk devar shbiyado. Since in the end, he will grow up. We made it as if it is within his control over here, and that's why there's Eidachad Ne'eman B'Yisurim over here. And the fact that this is working under the rubric of Eidachad Ne'eman B'Yisurim is important because then the cases are equivalent, which is that the father's right to be believed with regards to his daughter is a Torah principle. It's a Biti Natatali Shazeh. On the other hand, if you're just talking about the ages of the children, seemingly that's not an issue d'oraita. But if you put it under the rubric of Eidachad Ne'eman B'Yisurim, that's also a Ne'emanut de'oraita. And therefore now the case or the bright that you're bringing is supported by Rav Chisda's statement because then you're dealing with two dinim de'oraita. And we give believability to the father in certain circumstances, but not with regards to Makot ve'onshin. Then he asks, Miukasha ma'iriyav, afilu acher nami. If you're telling me that the whole reason that the father's believed over here is because Eidachad Ne'eman B'Yisurim, why is the father relevant? It could be any Eidachad. Why does it have to be the father's declaring the age? The answer he gives is, Yeshlamar da'av da'ik tfei l'dat shanav, fi shalav mutal odio l'acherim. Parents know the age of their children because people ask them. And they always have to declare or tell you what the child's age is. On the other hand, a third party might know the information, but they're not as careful about it because they're not the ones who are always involved about it. So therefore, there is a unique Eidachad Ne'eman B'Yisurim here for the parents about the age of their children. Because not only is an Eidachad Ne'eman B'Yisurim, but it's also the fact that they know the age and they're careful about the age. Those two things together give them the Ne'emanut over here, which would not be applicable to other parties. And again, would be that we're following this issue that it's Eidachad Ne'eman B'Yisurim, even though it's not B'Yado. So those two things are overcome by the parent because of the circumstances that surround it. Okay, we're going to stop here by the Mishnah on the top of Samach Dalet Amud Aleph.